Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Omar Farah, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, representing Guantanamo prisoners, who talks about the ongoing two-month-long hunger strike among U.S.-held Guantanamo detainees. Eric Kingston, co-director of the Strengthen Social Security campaign, who explains why a large coalition of groups across the U.S. are opposed to President Obama's proposed cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid benefits. And excerpts of a Yale University School of Forestry and Environmental Studies panel discussion on climate change and fracking. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In early April, World Bank President Jim Yong Kim outlined an ambitious goal to eliminate extreme poverty for those making less than $1.25 a day by boosting the income of the bottom 40% of wage earners by the year 2030. The World Bank's new vision comes as the United Nations Millennium Development Goal to slash poverty and boost global health winds down. In 1990, 43% of the world's population lived in extreme poverty. Today, that figure has fallen to 21%. The World Bank's goal is to reduce that to 3% by 2030. Didier Jacobs, who runs Oxfam America's lobbying office in Washington, D.C., liked the thrust of the World Bank's anti-poverty push. Still, he says the strategy needs more focus, telling the Interpress service the shared prosperity goal lacks a target. It is not enough to increase the income of the bottom 40% in every country. Income of the poor should rise faster than average, and the gap between the very rich and poor should be reduced. Nearly 25 years after the Soviet Army fled Afghanistan, Russia is planning to return to the war-torn nation to set up maintenance bases to service Russian-made military equipment purchased by NATO. These bases will open as United States and NATO troops prepare to leave after the upcoming Afghan election in 2014. The bases established under commercial contract are limited to maintaining and repairing Russian and Soviet-made military equipment, which makes up the bulk of the Afghan security forces' weaponry. Over the last decade, the U.S. bought Russian-made helicopters for Afghan security forces rather than more sophisticated equipment from the U.S. or Europe. Russia is eager to maintain a buffer in Afghanistan to keep Islamic insurgents out of Central Asia, block heroin trafficking, and develop joint projects on exploiting natural resources, including drilling for oil and managing water resources. To his supervisor, New York City police officer Pedro Serrano was slacking off by not stopping and frisking more residents in the poor South Bronx precinct he patrolled. In 2012, Officer Serrano only stopped two residents in the majority Black and Latino community. During a tense conversation in February of this year, which Serrano taped, Deputy Inspector Christopher McCormick accused Serrano of purposely not doing his job. The enforcement of New York City's stop-and-frisk policing strategy is on trial in federal court in Manhattan. New York police officers have the authority to stop and frisk a suspect if there is reasonable suspicion a crime is about to occur. Civil liberties advocates say the New York Police Department is abusing its authority by engaging in racial profiling. According to data released by the Center for Constitutional Rights, 87% of those stopped and frisked in New York City during 2012 were Blacks or Latinos. The number of stops has risen 400% under Mayor Michael Bloomberg, hitting a high in 2011 with over 650,000 people stopped. Yet, only 1.3% of stops resulted in finding a weapon, and only 6% of stops ended in an arrest. Over the last decade, the American Civil Liberties Union has sued both Philadelphia and Los Angeles police departments over stop-and-frisk tactics. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, that President Obama pledged to close during his first year in office, continues to operate 4 years later and is again the focus of attention for the treatment of prisoners held there. A widespread and growing hunger strike by an undetermined number of prisoners among the 166 men held at Guantanamo since early February has resulted in the force feeding of a number of strikers via tubes inserted into their noses and down to their stomachs. The Pentagon has recently blocked media access to the detention center. While a military spokesperson says there are only 40 hunger strikers at the facility, a federal public defender told the media that he believes that over 130 prisoners are participating. In a March 11th letter sent to his defense attorney, detainee Yasin Qasem Mohammed Ismail, who like many Guantanamo prisoners was picked up in Afghanistan after the U.S. invasion in 2011, wrote that he had lost 41 pounds. According to a translation of the letter released by his attorney, Ismail wrote, quote, "I believe I am going to die in this hunger strike, and this might be my last letter, or today is probably my last day in the world," unquote. While there are some accounts that say the hunger strike was triggered by guard searches of prisoners' copies of the Muslim Holy Quran, there is widespread acknowledgement that the protest has grown out of many prisoners' sense of hopelessness, with some detained for up to 11 years without charge or trial. While the U.S. government has cleared 86 detainees to be released, Congress and the White House have failed to take action to free them. Your reporter spoke with Omar Farah, staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who represents Guantanamo prisoners in habeas corpus challenges and in resettlement efforts. Here he talks about the reasons for the hunger strike and the legal and political issues that have contributed to this humanitarian crisis.
To the extent your listeners have seen reports of this, they'll see that the government itself is now conceding that roughly 40 prisoners are on a hunger strike at Guantanamo Bay. That number has been revised upwards almost on a daily basis for the last several weeks by the Department of Defense. And one interpretation of that is that the hunger strike is growing. The other, and I think the more accurate interpretation, is that the government is finally yielding to what the prisoners themselves have been saying since early February, which is that there is a mass hunger strike happening across the two primary detention facilities at Guantanamo Bay, which is Camp 6 and Camp 5. Camp 6 itself houses roughly 130 prisoners. And so what I've heard directly from my clients, including men like Fahed Ghazi, for example, is that all of the prisoners in Camp 6, for example, except those who are too old and too weak because of other medical conditions, are participating in the hunger strike. And we're starting to witness the predictable and dire consequences of that course of action. Men are collapsing. The Center for Constitutional Rights represents Ghaleb al-Bahani, for example. He's a diabetic. He's been told that his blood sugar levels are fluctuating so wildly that that they fear for his life. Increasingly, prisoners are being segregated into Camp 5 for more monitoring, and by the government's own numbers, roughly 11 prisoners are now being force-fed. And at Guantanamo, that means nasogastric intubation, being strapped down to a restraint chair, having a rubber tube inserted into your nose, and then liquid dietary supplements being pumped into your stomach. So we're talking now at a point where the situation is bleak, and if something doesn't change, I fear you'll be doing a follow-up story about the horrible deaths of a prisoner, either by suicide or by just expiring through the hunger strike, or even just through despair, which we know from last year with the death of Adnan Latif does in fact kill people.
Omar, tell our listeners a bit about the conditions and the open-ended nature of the prison sentences or lack of sentences at Guantanamo that has led to this hunger strike.
It's an important point, and it's one that's overlooked. The common perception, I think, is that torture has ended at Guantanamo Bay, and while some of the more obvious forms of torture, physical abuse and other forms of torture have ended, indefinite detention without charge or trial is indeed torture in any common understanding of the term. I think, most people can conceive of what it would be like to be beaten up by someone more powerful. We can all sort of get our minds around the shame that we would feel if we were stripped naked in front of others. It's very hard for people who have their freedom to contemplate what it means to be locked up in a steel and concrete cell for a decade, to not really know why you're there to begin with, and to not know when, if ever, you'll leave. And that's the torment that is happening across the prison. And I know from visiting and meeting with my clients that, that uncertainty is destroying them over time. And we were pleased to hear the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights on Friday come out and decisively condemn the situation at Guantanamo Bay for precisely this reason. And she was saying that there's no other outcome you could possibly expect other than this kind of hunger strike, this kind of protest, when people are locked up in that kind of condition. So, you know, there's a degree of existential torment that these men are dealing with daily. And your listeners should recall that more than half of them have been unanimously cleared for release by every national security and law enforcement agency in the U.S. government that has, you know, a stake in this issue, and they're just trapped there in this limbo. It's devastating.
Omar, given the fact that a commission appointed by President Obama has recommended the release of these prisoners and they are in this limbo status with this hunger strike ongoing, very dangerous to the lives of many, what can be done now to intervene here? President Obama, members of his administration, the judiciary, or members of Congress, who can intervene to bring some semblance of justice to these men?
You know, to be fair, all three branches of government have utterly failed on Guantanamo policy. You know, at this late stage, it's less important, I think, to talk about the courts, because you know they closed the door on these cases a long time ago. The Congress has been equally hostile towards the Guantanamo detainees. The annual defense appropriation bill, the National Defense Authorization Act, has been a vehicle for Congress to express its disfavor for the president's plan to close Guantanamo. And so there's these very onerous restrictions that complicate the ability of the president to transfer. But this issue, this current crisis, begins and ends with President Obama. And as difficult as the framework is for him to operate in, he has sufficient latitude to significantly draw down the prison population in rapid order by transferring the men. The National Defense Authorization Act includes provisions that would permit him to sidestep the worst of the transfer restrictions that he often complains about, including in his signing statement. It permits him, for example, to transfer a prisoner if he determined that it was in the national security interest to do so. So if the president were committed to transferring the prisoners, at a minimum transferring the 86 men that have already been cleared for release, he needs only turn to the provisions that are already included in existing legislation. But he's determined, he deserves harsh criticism for this, he's determined that other political priorities are more important. But in this case, there are literally men's lives hanging in the balance.
That was Omar Farah, staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative. Find more news and analysis about the Guantanamo hunger strike by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. President Obama's proposed federal budget that was unveiled on April 10th provoked the ire of many progressive groups that had supported him in his last two presidential election campaigns. The flashpoint for anger, and in some cases charges of betrayal, sprang from the White House plan to impose changes to the Social Security system's cost of living adjustment formula, known as Chain CPI, reducing benefits totaling $100 billion or more over the next 10 years. The president is also calling for $400 billion in cost savings from the Medicare and Medicaid programs, which assist both senior citizens and the poor and disabled. A day before the budget was to be announced, progressive legislators from both the House and Senate, joined by organizers from 15 national groups, gathered in front of the White House to present 2 million petition signatures opposed to Mr. Obama's proposed cuts to Social Security and Medicare. Many activists who are gearing up for a fight against the entitlement program cuts point to public opinion polls that overwhelmingly find that Democrats, Republicans, and independent voters oppose any cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid benefits. White House spokesman Dan Pfeiffer told reporters that the president only supports reductions in Social Security and Medicare benefits if the Republicans in Congress accept closing tax loopholes that benefit the wealthiest and there are protections for the most vulnerable, including the oldest senior citizens. But opponents of the White House compromise offer to the GOP say that the very groups who worked hardest to reelect the president will be the ones hurt most by the cuts being proposed. Your reporter spoke with Eric Kingson, co-director of the Strengthen Social Security campaign, who explains why his coalition of 300 national and state organizations representing over 50 million Americans oppose President Obama's proposed cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
The proposal that's being put forward I first and foremost must be understood as a cut, C-U-T. It's called the chain CPI. It would change the way the cost of living adjustment is made in Social Security on an annual basis. It sounds innocuous. It sounds very wonky. There are some wonks who've lined up and said, this is a better way to measure inflation. But the reality is what it means is it cuts the cost of living adjustment each year by 0.3 percentage point. Over 10 years, that means in year 10, if you have a 65-year-old grandfather retiring today, in year 10, that on average, that grandfather would be or grandmother would be receiving about $700 less in that year. In year 20, when they're 85, they would receive about $1,200 less. And in year 30, when if they reach 95, about $1,700 less. What's most concerning is, well, there are a number of things. The language that's used, they call this a little tweak. This is just a little tweak in benefits. This is not a tweak. This is $28,000 if you live to age 95, out of the pockets of beneficiaries. They also have said very, very clearly in the presidential campaign, in the congressional campaigns, the president has said he will not slash benefits. This goes against that promise. Almost all politicians have said they will not cut benefits on people 55 and over. This goes against that promise. And it does it in a disingenuous way. They try to sell this notion that inflation is overprotected in Social Security with the cost of living adjustment. What they're trying to say is that people with disabilities, older people, veterans, many of whom receive Social Security, they've been getting too large a cost of living adjustment. This past year, they got a 1.7% cost of living adjustment. Meanwhile, their Medicare premium goes up. Their health care costs go up. So they're saying that 1.7% was too much. A couple of years ago, they got nothing. They're saying that was too much.
Eric, there are many defenders of the president who say that this is part of political theater, that people on the left, progressives, shouldn't get too upset because the president's playing three-dimensional chess while we're all playing checkers. How do you respond to the idea that there's some kind of wisdom in this strategy of offering these benefit cuts to Social Security and Medicare and some better purpose that's unspoken?
You know, if that is the case, they're being too smart by half. They're destroying the public's confidence in the system. A part of Social Security is to provide security, the purpose of it. It is there to provide broad security to the American public if people lose wages because of a parent dying, a parent becoming disabled, a spouse becoming disabled, or you reach retirement ages. Part of what it does is provide peace of mind. If the president is doing this in a disingenuous way, and I hope that's not the case, I hope he's being forthright in saying this is what I believe, because I think it is what he believes. It's certainly what a lot of the Republicans want. If he's doing this for political purposes, then he's gambling with the well-being of the future of this institution, and he's playing a cruel joke on the American people. Yes, he's been using this as a bargaining chip, certainly, to get the Republicans to play a little bit on raising some taxes, as they should well do. But you don't need to do this. His own Secretary of the Treasury, Jack Lew, has made it clear in an op-ed, I think it was in USA Today, saying Social Security has nothing to do with the federal deficit and the federal debt. Three-dimensional chess may be a fine game, but not when you're playing with people's lives.
Eric, are you concerned that the GOP, which has rejected this offer of benefit cuts to Social Security and Medicare before, since negotiations began in the summer of 2011 from the White House, that they may accept it this time and call the president's bluff and press hard to get this done, to make these cuts?
It's possible. I would put it another way. I think what is more likely to happen is that the GOP will try to hang this proposal around the White House and all congressional Democrats who are up for election in 2014. The president doesn't have to run for re-election again, but many members of his party do have to run, and they will be running at their peril if they support any kind of cut to the COLA. And there's, even if they don't support a cut, I'm going to guess that the Republicans are going to talk about the Democratic proposal to cut your Social Security benefits.
That was Eric Kingson, co-director of the Strengthen Social Security campaign. Learn more about the coalition's work to protect social safety net programs by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Yale University School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, along with the Sierra Club, sponsored a March 27th panel discussion on energy policy and climate change on the Yale campus. Speakers included Connecticut's U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal, Nadine Unger, Assistant Professor of Atmospheric Chemistry at Yale, and Anthony Lasserowitz, Director of the Forestry School's Project on Climate Change Communication. During the forum, each panelist made a short presentation, followed by questions from the audience. One important question posed to the panel dealt with a method of natural gas extraction known as hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. In fracking, large amounts of water and chemicals are pumped underground to break up tight shale formations and release the oil and natural gas within. Critics opposed to fracking point to evidence of groundwater pollution resulting from the injection of a proprietary brew of toxic chemicals. What follows is an excerpt of the panelists' response to this question. Is the natural gas boom in fracking ultimately going to be a positive or negative development for those worried about climate change? Senator Blumenthal responds first, followed by Unger and Lasserowitz.
Number one, I think fracking obviously has grave perils. Safeguards are necessary, but the potential for more natural gas, I think, is a real opportunity. But what we really need in this country is an energy policy that incentivizes and drives renewables of all kinds, solar, thermal, wind, fuel cells. The state of Connecticut is the fuel cell capital of the country. We make fuel cells here in greater number than anywhere else. We could be the fuel cell capital of the world. Again, another way environmental protection, smart energy policy can be an economic boon if we just had an energy policy that favored tax credits. You know, I spend time with the fuel cell producers of Connecticut and the United States, and other countries are encouraging manufacturing of fuel cells. We need to look beyond fracking to those sources of energy, renewable energy, clean energy, that can not only benefit us in terms of the environment going forward, but can offer even greater opportunities than new sources of natural gas, as good as they may be, because natural gas is cleaner, but other sources where we can lead the world and lead by example. That's what the United States can do, is lead by example.
Blumenthal was followed by Nadine Unger.
In terms of natural gas and fracking, the latest climate science is clear on that natural gas is not any better for climate than coal. It is better for air quality, but not for global warming. A serious problem with natural gas is leakage of methane. And there is a serious lack of measurements of methane emissions and volatile organic carbon emissions from fracking sites and natural gas extraction sites in the U.S. In fact, this industry has grown so rapidly that these emissions are not even included in the U.S. EPA National Emissions Inventory. They're not on the map. So we certainly need to have a more extensive measurement campaign before we can say anything more definitive about natural gas in the United States.
Unger was followed by Anthony Lazarowicz.
Yeah, I'm going to channel my colleague Jim Sayers. We had a whole panel on this, a fascinating panel on this last year, and you know he was very clear that the science is still very new about the ultimate consequences of this rush into fracking and into natural gas. Yes, when you burn it in a power plant, it produces half the CO2 of coal, and that's important. However, when you do a full life cycle analysis, from the well all the way through the pipes, through the distribution system, and into that plant, it's not clear yet. We actually just don't know. And yet we're rushing into this boom without having that scientific basis of knowledge. And that's, of course, of concern to those of us in the scientific community. So we don't really know yet. And we don't know how solvable that is. You know, even if we do find that the wells leak or that the pipes leak and so on, are those fixable? Or is there something fundamentally wrong? The other is, of course, this is a huge question of trade-offs. Coal is an old and dirty and polluting and terrible energy source for all kinds of reasons. And yet, you know, natural gas does burn cleaner. It's better for health. It's maybe better for climate change, too. Okay? And it's a lot cheaper. Okay, I mean, I'm just saying, we don't fully know. And there are all these other trade-offs. You know, the communities that have to endure the fracking boom, it's an incredible transformation of the local landscape, the local soundscape, the local smellscape, and everything else. And I think the one other concern that I think many people would point to is that this incredible new energy source, which is American, and it's not imported, however, has been so cheap that it's making it harder for renewables to compete, that it's actually making it harder to have the market incentives for solar and wind and geothermal and all the other things that we know are much cleaner.
That was Anthony Lazarowicz, director of the Yale School of Forestry's Project on Climate Change Communication. He was preceded by Nadine Unger, a professor of atmospheric chemistry at Yale, and U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal, speaking at a March 27th Yale Forum on climate change. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Find links to more discussion on fracking's impact on the environment by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.